That's on.
Yeah. All right. So it's November 16th, 2019, here at Narkey Street Congregation, and we are going to be going over the Book of Numbers this morning very briefly in our review and summary of the Trinom Parasha. So, is there anything you want to start off with? As we look at, everybody has a handout? Okay.
We're looking at Numbers. Once again, if you compare the annual parasha to the triennial parasha.
Right, the annual is on the left side here. It's got the underline. This is what would be read in the synagogue or what we read in the church downstairs.
You will find that there are only two places that are the same. This first one on the first page, Hosea 2, 1 through 22. That's loud. And on the second page, Joshua 2, 1 through 24. I'm going to show this one on the second page. So it's interesting to us to compare these two because so much of it is different material, what people are reading today every week and what people were reading then every week. And so that's been our fascination. And, of course, we've pointed out before, if you have a larger chunk in the Torah to cover, there's more material there that you can highlight. So, for instance, in this first selection, Hosea 2, 1 through 22 is what they chose for that whole chunk of Numbers 1 to Numbers 4, 20. But then if you break it down smaller chunks, we have much more additional material. We have Hosea 2. Additionally, Isaiah 35, Isaiah 49, Isaiah 8, Isaiah 45, 46. And if you follow the, there are two versions of this triennial parasha. If you follow the second one that's in bold, you have Micah 4, 2 as well as Isaiah 2, 3. So again, this just highlights how much different material and more material was being read. And again, a lot from the book of Isaiah. Did you run any statistics on Isaiah this week?
Yes.
It's fascinated us, this whole study, how much relates back to Isaiah.
First off, you'll notice in the annual Haftarah here for Numbers, how often is Isaiah read? That's this column here. How many times? There's 10 parashot for Numbers. How many times is Isaiah?
Nine.
So that's a first, that Isaiah doesn't even appear in Numbers, which, you know, you could maybe explain for different reasons, but it doesn't exist here in the annual parasha. And we pointed out before in Genesis, Exodus, and Leviticus with Isaiah as well for the annual parasha that the percentage was low. Genesis, it was 25%. Exodus, it was 18%. Leviticus, it was 10% for the parasha. And here it's 0%. And what's also fascinating is next week we'll be looking at Deuteronomy. And any guess how many times Isaiah appears in Deuteronomy?
In the annual parasha?
In the annual parasha. Just from your practice recollection.
No,
the entire.
Oh.
In the annual parasha in Deuteronomy, every one is Isaiah.
That's
and
interesting.
It's very, very interesting.
Interesting.
So.
And when you think about Second Temple times, if you look at Qumran, you look at New Testament, major books that were being quoted were Deuteronomy and Isaiah, Psalms. I mean, those just keep getting quoted everywhere.
So there'll be a major shift next week for the annual. It will go completely Isaiah. So obviously there's an agenda, there's a purpose for that. But coming back to Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Isaiah is a lower percentage or quite low. But when we look at the triennial, which is what we've been doing here, the percentage for Isaiah is very high, right? It's this middle column here. And Isaiah appears 57.5% of the time. Here, Numbers, Leviticus, it was 55%. Exodus, it was 64%. Genesis was 64%. So,
wait, what is it for us?
57. So it's a preponderance of Isaiah in the triennial in general for all five books. So we'll probably talk more about that in 2 weeks when we come to the final conclusion. So, but maybe we could talk about just the book of Numbers here. In English, we call Bamidbar, this book from the Hebrew Scriptures, Numbers. Why? You're counting people. There's a lot of numbers.
Especially as the book starts out, it sets the people in how they camped and all the different lineages and where they should camp and what their job is, and it gives numbers for each category, and they're huge numbers. And so you get this impression there's all these numbers being recorded.
It's like it's a bureaucratic book, in a sense. For a certain portion of it, there's a lot of numbers, there's a lot of details when it comes to logistics, when it comes to how they function as a society. And you're dealing often with the tribes and their roles. And even more specifically, it starts to focus on one tribe in particular, which would be what? What's the most significant in the functioning of the Israelite society? The Levites, right? Because this is where all of your...
Depending how you judge society, right? You could go with Judah or Levi.
But if you read the books of Moses, it's not... Until you get to King David, do you start to even think of... Or Chronicles, do you start to think about how that side of the government functions? I would argue it's the tabernacle. Mm-hmm. It's the sacrificial system. It's all of... That's really where the core, the beating heart of the society is for these books, Leviticus, Exodus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, and so on. So it's and so what's going on specifically within the Levites is you're talking about the priest. The priests are a subset of the Levites, right? They're coming out of Aaron, So they all even are broken down even further, right? There's the three, what do you call them, clans within Levi? Do you remember what are their names?
Like Merari.
The Merari.
Kohath.
Kohath and Gershon, right?
What's the three again?
Let's just go there. Numbers.
Yeah, let's, read it
together, as I said. Let's see. Numbers 4. So there's Kohath.
Yeah.
Right. And then there's Gershon. And then there's the Merarites.
Kohath, Gershon, Merari.
Well, Kohath is first, verse 1, and it goes to verse 20. And then verse 21 is Gershonites. That goes to 28. And 29 goes to verse 33 with the Merarites. So all of this to say is kind of a big picture of what we're looking at in this book. We're looking at logistics. We're looking at the tribes, then we're looking at one tribe in particular, the Levites, and out of them we're even breaking it down further. You've got...
Well, the logistics is based on responsibilities.
Right, jobs.
Yeah, like these people have to carry all the tent supplies, these people have to do this.
So you have Kohath, you have Gershon, and then you have Merari, and you also then have the Aaronites. I can call, if I can use that term, which are the ones that the priests come out of. So you really have four major clans that are discussed in this book. So, am I missing anything here, or any other thoughts about numbers?
I say the book has a lot to do with authority, because you have some of the major rebellions against Moses and Aaron. Throughout this book, stories are interwoven into the big picture of the social organization. And the stories are there to show something about the God-ordained authority and who's been set in what place and why.
You could probably say the first, the chapters in Exodus, let's say around 15 of Exodus until about Exodus 34, you've got a lot of stories there dealing with the wilderness, right? The people are leaving Egypt. And so in Numbers, you've got about 15 chapters that are interwoven with those chapters from Exodus. And so sometimes you're getting new stories and sometimes you're hearing the same story again, but with some different details. Mm-hmm. So
it's a little overlap.
There's an overlap between Exodus and Numbers, dealing specifically with the wilderness as well.
So you want to go into your first one?
Okay, so this morning we'll just look at a couple examples here from the readings and discuss them. And, let's look maybe at number 105, the triennial parasha 105. It's that far column here. And it's Numbers chapter 7.
And 105... See, doesn't exist.
And here's some...
In the bold.
Right, and in the bold is 107, but I don't want to get it all confused. 105, the first number there. Number 7, if you have your Bibles, turn to number 7. And we'll go to verse 48. I'm just going to read these 41 verses here. On the seventh day...
41?
Elishama, son of Amihud... Okay, I'm joking. I'm not going to read these 41 verses here. But he is the leader of which people?
Ephraim.
Okay, Ephraim. I didn't know that Ephraim was a son of Jacob.
Well, isn't it?
He's not.
He's an adopted son of Jacob.
He's an adopted son of Jacob, right? What's the son? No, he's a son of Joseph, but he's an adopted son of Jacob.
Well, he is a son of Jacob, right?
I mean, he's a grandson.
Exactly.
Right.
But that's how you
in terms of inheritance,
right.
They were adopted. Joseph's two sons were adopted by Jacob so that Joseph could get a double portion.
You remember specifically Jacob before he died, he called in Joseph and he says, bring your two grandsons. Right.
Yeah, so instead of giving one portion to Joseph that he would split between his two sons, if he can adopt Joseph's sons directly, they each get a portion.
And that's
the end of Genesis, that he does that.
Right. But all of this to say, here in number 7, Ephraim, the son of Joseph, who's now the son of Jacob in a legal sense, is part of the 12 tribes. And why is this important here for what we're reading in the prophets? So let's go to Jeremiah 31, because we don't have a lot of time to bring it all up. Did we talk about Jeremiah 31 last week? Or was it 2 weeks ago? It was 2 weeks ago. Okay. So let's go to verse 19. Jeremiah 31, start in 19.
We need some more.
Actually, I'll just start in 20. Indeed, the people of Israel are my dear children. Okay, wait a second. Yeah, I'm looking at this translation. I'm like, no, I don't... So I was reading the NET translation, and they have a very liberal translation there. But in the Hebrew it says, my son is very precious to me, Ephraim. So, it's...
Which verse are you reading?
This is Jeremiah 31:20.
Then yakir li Ephraim.
I'm reading 20, verse 20.
So we're going off the bold parentheses passage?
Yeah, I mean, because of time's sake, we'll go with starting verse 20. But my son Ephraim is dear to me. What do your translations have there?
People of Israel.
Okay, you have people of Israel. Why is the translation saying the people of Israel there?
That's going
to
be the line.
The line? Well, what is Ephraim? What is Ephraim in the prophets? It's just another name for Israel.
Yeah.
If you read Hosea, it talks about Ephraim left and right.
And Israel here in the sense of northern kingdom.
Yes, right? We had the rebellion against Solomon's son, and Jeroboam set up the northern kingdom, and it's often called Israel, but the prophets often call it Ephraim. And why does it call Israel, the northern kingdom, Ephraim? We talked about this a couple years ago.
That's
where Ephraim was. Ephraim was in the north. And Ephraim, if you go back to number 7 and you look at the numbers, we also talked about this. You lay out the camps of the tribes, right? There was the northern camps, the western, the east, the southern. Who was one of the largest tribes out of all the 12 tribes? Ephraim. Ephraim is huge. They're, for whatever reason, they're a big camp. Who are some of the famous people in the Bible that come from Ephraim?
Joshua.
Joshua.
He's big.
He was. If Moses is the most famous leader of Israel prior to the monarchy, Joshua is probably the second most famous leader, and he's coming from Ephraim. So, Ephraim is a significant player in the whole history of Israel and how they play out. So the translation has some credence when it says, you know, the people of Israel. But if you look into the Hebrew and it just says specifically Ephraim, that's what's going to hit you, yeah. Ephraim. And then you start thinking about all the correlations going back to the very beginning.
And what strikes me also when you think about personification, when you're talking about one person like Ephraim, he's a son, but he's symbolizing all of Israel. That's really fascinating because we have the same thing that's going to happen when we talk about Messiah, this one person that's for the salvation of many. And so there's two things I think we're going to see this morning. A poetic description of the one that actually refers to the many.
And what's his name mean, Ephraim?
Ephraim, from Ephraim.
Like poe.
Pri, no fruit to multiply.
Pru up, you know.
Pru urvu.
Yeah, pru urvu, from Genesis 1, where it talks about be fruitful and multiply. So there's this idea of fruitful, and if he's obviously is such a large tribe in number 7 and so on, it kind of plays out prophetically. Let's keep reading here in Jeremiah 31. We don't have a lot of time. I just want to point out a couple things here. So Ephraim is my dear son. They are the children I take delight in. Or actually, again, this is a translation here, but the child of my delight or of delight. And even though I often must rebuke them, I still remember them with fondness, so I'm deeply moved with pity for them. And again, this translation is ignoring that it's a singular, it's talking about him, Ephraim, who will have compassion on him. So come down to it goes into the basically, Ephraim is unfaithful. Ephraim is the son that, I guess, prodigal son, represents the whole people, the people that have turned away from the Lord. And often when you talk about this stuff, you're talking about idolatry, right? This is kind of the main problem. Okay, so now come down to 27, because Jeremiah 31 is this major passage that's often connected into the New Testament, talking about Jesus, where, you know, the time is coming, like verse 27. I will cause people and animals to sprout up in the land and the lands of Israel and Judah. So you're getting this picture here of like sowing and fruit coming forth. And in the past, I saw to it that they were uprooted and torn down, but they were destroyed and demolished. But now I will see to it that they are built up and firmly planted. Verse 29, when that time comes, people will no longer say the parents have eaten sour grapes, but the children's teeth have grown numb. This is a proverb that Ezekiel uses. Essentially, what the parents do, the children inherit the curse that comes along with it. Verse 30, rather each person will die for his own sins. This is also straight in Ezekiel, right? The teeth of the person who eats the sour grapes will themselves grow numb. Okay, verse 31. Here it is. A time is coming, says the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the people of Israel and Judah. And it's verse 32. It will not be like the old covenant that I made with their ancestors when I delivered them from Egypt, for they violated that covenant, even though I was like a faithful husband to them, says the Lord. Now, what do you notice here in verse 32?
In verse 32,
coming with Ephraim's name,
they violated the covenant.
Yeah,
it's kind of a play on words. Lehafer is to make it null, and so instead of Ephraim, instead of playing off the abundance. Multiplication and abundance, it kind of has a sound play with they've violated the covenant. Even though I was their husband.
Did everybody catch that? Ephraim's name, in its core, has this idea of abundance and fruit, good fruit. But here you could find this connection for how this Haftarah, how this prophetic reading's tied in together. That Ephraim is a bad boy. Right, he's actually broken. Instead of making good fruit, he violated, he broke, he annulled the covenant. But what does God say here? That he's making a new covenant.
Mm-hmm.
New covenant with them. And he will plant them back in the land. And this really is kind of like the whole, we're going to touch on this theme in Numbers. The people are in the wilderness, and what's the whole goal for why they're in the wilderness? What's their goal? To come in the land.
Mm-hmm.
They never... Sorry?
Both their goals. They leave Egypt to come into the promised land.
The goal is to get in the land.
Sure.
Do they ever get in the land in Numbers? No. Do they ever arrive into Canaan? No. In Deuteronomy, do they ever arrive? No. It's only with Joshua. And Joshua, I guess you could say, you know, he's from Ephraim.
So the one Ephraimite that gets in.
He's the Ephraimite who gets in.
And Caleb from Judah.
Right, Caleb from Judah.
So you have the single representatives for the future nation of Israel.
Those are the two most powerful tribes. It was Judah and
Ephraim. And the two kingdoms.
The two kingdoms, right. The south and the north. South is Judah, the north is Ephraim.
So you have that idea of the remnant that will... be multiplied.
But anyway, just to bring this all together here, hear this connection in 105, number 7. You have the first verse, verse 48 of number 7, talks about the tribe of Ephraim. And in Jeremiah 31, it talks about Ephraim, who's the delinquent, the son who's gone off and broken and violated, mm-hmm. rather than being responsible and reproducing and producing good fruit. And here God is saying... It'll be this kind of, I think, theme that for what Israel is not able to do, God steps in and carries them in.
It's interesting because it's a mixed metaphor, because Ephraim is both the son and then he also becomes a wife in this passage.
Because, and probably alluding to idolatry, maybe.
Well, in verse 32, where it says, "You broke the covenant, heferu, even though I was a husband to you, vanuchi ba'alti van, or I was a husband to them." So, liv'ol is to consummate marriage, and that whole metaphor we talked about before. So, when you hear that in the context, that emphasizes this play on, instead of producing fruit, which is the normal consequence of consummating marriage, you broke the covenant. So that's a nice contrast there. And then, of course, they go on, they play on the name Baal.
The god Baal. The fertility god for produce or fruit.
But here, you know, he's describing this new covenant, this new thing, and it's going to be binding in a deeper way. It's going to be written on your hearts, and you have this this same, in verse 33, "I will be for them a God, and they will be for me a people." That's like a formulaic speech when you're, you know, it's like wedding vows. And so this same renewal of a covenant, but on a deeper level.
So why don't we continue this to Numbers 14? Numbers 14, and we're looking at on the second page, number 111, the Haftarah of 111. Numbers 14.
Did we check how many times Jeremiah 31 comes in the annual Haftarah?
We'll do that later.
Okay, so we'll do that later, because that is also fascinating.
What is Numbers 14 happening? What's going on here in Numbers 14? Speaking of Joshua and Caleb. Sorry? Who comes back? The 12 spies, right? So they've been sent into the land to spy it out, and then they're going to enter. The whole goal is to go into Canaan, to enter this good land. And the 12 spies come back. And 10 of them say, "We cannot do this." But the two, Joshua and Caleb, which we've now mentioned now, are the ones who say, "Yes, we can do it."
Yes, and we can.
Yes, we can. And
and they want to stone them because of that.
Look at verse 3 there. Numbers 14:3. "Why has the Lord brought us into this land only to be killed by the sword, that our wives and our children should become plunder, lavaz?" Y'all, the word for plunder or prey, baz. And so then God says to Joshua, basically, "I'm going to kill these people. I'm done with them. I don't have time for this." Why? Because they're rebelling. They're going to stone Moses and Joshua too. Verse 10. And so verse 11, what does God say? "The Lord said to Moses, 'How long will this people despise me?
Yena'atsuni.
How long will they not believe in me? In spite of the signs that I have done among them, I will strike them with the pestilence and I will disinherit them. I will make you into a nation that is greater and mightier than they." Okay. This is our context here. And one other thing I just want to point out is it says here, how does this... the story go here? God says, "I'm going to wipe them out," and then Moses says, "What? No, don't do that. What should God do?"
When the Egyptians hear it,
yeah, they'll decide to wipe them out, right? And then, so what does he say? What does he tell God to do? Forgive them. Forgive these people that are Verse 19.
According to your great love.
Yes. According to your chesed.
Your faithful love.
Your loyalty.
Because you have given all this way, all
yeah.
these many times.
Yeah. Oh, look, it's raining in the sun right there.
Oh, nice.
Pretty awesome.
Slach. Slach is where we get slicha today. It has a sense of making amends. Like, consider it amended. It reminds me of today, if you have two families that are feuding in the Arab society, you have a meeting, a sulha, and you sit down and you eat a dinner together and you make amends. You decide, okay, from here on out, you can't bring this up anymore. It's done. And it's kind of that idea. But it also says, just as you have carried this people from Egypt until here. And laset avon, to carry iniquity, is the major idiom in the Bible to forgive iniquity, to carry it, to lift it away. And here it's mixing that idiom with carrying the people from Egypt to here. So it kind of is saying, this whole time in the desert, you've been carrying their iniquities. Kind of like I see that as a little bit of a play there.
Look at verse 31. Verse 31. But I will bring in your little ones, whom you said would become victims of war. Remember the ones that are going to be plunder? That, why have you brought us here? So our wives and our children will be plunder. And they... It's the, you know, it's the same word here, Baz. They will enjoy the land that you have despised. So not only have they kind of despised God, they've despised the land or the promise of this land. There's this kind of rejection going on here. This is, I'm trying to paint here this theme of rejection, rejection, rejection. Mm-hmm. Now, what do we have in the...
And there the children are carrying the adultery or the fornication of the people.
This is the set of home. Like, is the imagery like carried away or to bear, like to take it on? It's both.
Yeah.
It can actually mean either like forgive or not forgive, depending on the context.
Yeah.
What is it more though? I mean, it depends on.
Anytime you have something that can go two ways, you're going to have an interpretation involved. Because each context you read, you have to decide what it means in that context.
I mean, it depends on the arguments. Like if you are going to bear your sin, like then it has to be that, yeah, I'm going to bear your sin.
Then it's forgiving. Yeah.
Right? So you're taking it away from me. But
yeah.
Are you taking it away to dispose of it in the trash, or are you taking it on to as a weight for the rest of your life?
Well, we're going to get to this in Micah 7.
Yeah, I was going to say.
So,
before we get there.
Yeah, before we get there, though, it's fascinating because we have two kind of messianic symbols today. We better get there on time. So go to
the what's
Isaiah
the Haftarah here? What's the prophetic reading for this section?
Isaiah 53, guys.
You have 52. That's the one. That's the major one, probably. But there was one. There's one text that had this Isaiah 53:5, which or 53:3.
I guess it's ambiguous. Is what I'm saying. Either way, it means the same exact thing. Like you pick up some like iniquity, but it depends on who's picking it up.
No, I'm saying when you say English to bear. Right. If you're going to bear it, you're going to keep it. It's going to stay on you. Right? If you're going to bear something for me, it means you take it, it stays on you. Whereas if you carry something away, it means like you're going to take it away from me, you're going to throw in the trash, and it's not going to stay on you.
It's washed away.
But you can bear something away. You know,
yeah.
I can bear your sin and bring it somewhere else. And dry.
It's the same in the very physical usage of lasset. Lasset, it can mean just to pick something up, and it can mean to carry it, like bring it somewhere else. So either you're carrying it statically, or you're carrying it to a destination.
That's what I'm saying. There is no distinguishing.
There's no distinguishing in the word.
Whereas I'm saying the word to bear, it does have that. Like when we say that in English, you know, like he bore our sins,
he carried our iniquities.
Very specifically, that he took it on and it caused him pain. He took on all of the
identification.
He took on all of the consequences of it. Is what mm-hmm. I'm saying. Whereas,
but it also means he got rid of it when we say that.
Well, for sure he got rid of it. Yeah. No, that goes without saying. What I'm saying is like,
how much is within that idiom of bearing it away?
If you can take I can help you take that away for you. Like I can remember track for you. When you say to bear it, means you take it on and then you get the bad stuff instead of you.
Well, what if the original idiom came from the idea that sin is something there, it's palpable. It doesn't just disappear. So to forgive someone means you have to take it off of them.
Yeah.
It's got to go somewhere, right? So you carry it instead of them.
Yeah.
And then if you're God, at that point, it can dissipate.
Whatever happens, when it happens.
Yeah.
It's definitely support for that, that idea, you know, going forward. Like,
you go actually carrying.
Okay. Sorry.
Sorry.
Just to look at the text, Isaiah 52, 5.
Yes.
That very first verse, before we get to the big, you know, Isaiah 53 and what is all of this with the Messiah. But Isaiah 52, 5, what's it say? My people have been carried away for nothing.
You know.
Okay, yeah, it's not Nasa there, but in the sense they've been taken,
mm-hmm.
like captive.
Like plundered, captive,
like in war, which is what Babylon did to them. And what, keep going? What's the problem here, though? Obviously, people are suffering and all of this. The big problem is,
my name is being
what?
Insulted.
Slandered. Or despised. It's that same word that you have back in Numbers 14, when it says that the people have despised or slandered God. And so the problem here isn't maybe like I reject you with my words publicly, but I've rejected you with my actions, like idolatry, or
not being faithful,
like a husband and a wife.
Even in the Numbers passage we read that they didn't have faith, and that brought... That was despising God's name.
Yes.
Like how you act. If you act out of faith, you're upholding God's name. You're sanctifying it. And if you act without faith, you're causing his name to be despised.
And I also just want to highlight here, if you keep reading here, this is that famous verse, how, you know, beautiful it is to see the feet of someone bringing good news on the mountains. And it's where we have the neighborhood Mebuset at Zion. His name comes from this chapter. And the one bringing it to Zion. That's what I want to point out. In Numbers 14, the focus is we got to get to the land, the good land. We got to get into Canaan. And Isaiah 52, the focus is now Jerusalem. It's bringing good news to Jerusalem. Jerusalem becomes the epicenter of the land and the focal point. It represents all the hopes in the past and all the hopes in the future for what God has for his people. And you could basically argue that with that messianic idea of, you know, that a Messiah brings peace, a Messiah brings...
So do we get to read...
Salvation,
Isaiah 53:3?
Right. So, okay, so look at Isaiah 53. And the verse that... I just found this as I was compiling things this last week. We didn't mention this in a Bible study a couple years ago because this is in Ofer's compilation of text with the Haftarot. Isaiah 53:3. What's the verse there? If you have it, just read it.
Nivzeh. Go ahead.
People despised and avoided him, a man of pains, well acquainted with illness. Like someone from whom people turn their faces, he was despised. We did not value him.
So the Hebrew here is a different word. It's not the word that you have in Numbers 14, but it's still in that same general idea, this same kind of theme that's been painted of people, the people of Israel, despising God or despising the land or despising the good things of God. And here, it's being put on one person. People are despising this person.
It's a person of machovot, pains or sorrows. And he knows, he has intimate knowledge of sickness, holy.
And everybody, in Isaiah 53, what's the context? What is this person carrying on him? Talking about Danny's, your comments, and Kevin.
Well, in the next verse, truly our sicknesses he carried, and our pains he bore. Svalam. And it's interesting to go back to the same debate. These are, lisbol and laset are two synonyms. Sovel literally means to carry a load. And it also is a word that means to, what am I looking for in English?
Suffer.
So the carrying is that taking it on you, and you're suffering. You are bearing that. It's interesting to me because this is a very messianic passage, right? Everybody comes to that. This concept of being despised and not being thought about. Chashavnuhu. We didn't consider him, or we didn't think about him. I was looking at the other passage that we're going to get to in a second.
I mean, we can go there now if you want.
Are you sure?
Sure.
Okay.
Because it might actually give more interpretation.
Yeah, it's fleshing out the same metaphor. And again, I'm seeing this metaphor of one son, one person. In one case, it's symbolizing Israel. In another case, it's symbolizing the Messiah. It's really fascinating. So I'm thinking about Numbers 22.
The last page.
On the last page.
117.
117 or 118 in the parentheses for the triennial parasha. It's Numbers 22, verse 2 to 41. But then also followed by Numbers 23, 1 to 24, 25. And these, of course, are the Bilam oracles.
Balaam.
Balaam. And his oracles are fascinating because a lot of our messianic verses and understandings come from here. And who is Bilam? He's not even an Israel. He's not from Israel. He's this foreign, I don't know what you call him. Do you want to call him a magician?
Seer.
Seer. And yet he has these pictures that are so amazing. And if you look in the annual Haftarah, you will see that Micah 5, verse 6 to 6, 8 is the annual portion. And go there quickly, just to refresh yourself.
And that would be in the English 5, 7.
Okay.
5, verse 7.
Those survivors, those leftovers from Jacob, will live in the midst of many nations. And they're going to be like dew. They're going to be like a lion among the animals of the forest, a young lion among the sheep, which, of course, devours its prey. Go down. Look at verse 12. I will remove the sorcery.
Verse 13 in English.
Verse 13. The kshafim that you practice, and you will no longer have omen readers. Me'onanim. So this kind of the sorcery and omen readers kind of reminds you of Bilam, this foreign person, and then it actually mentions him. Where is he? And jump down into chapter 6, verse 4, it says, I sent Moses, Aaron, and Miriam to lead you. My people, verse 5, my people, recall how King Balak of Moab planned to harm you, how Bilam ben Beor responded to him. And so it's bringing into people's memory that exact passage. So it's clear that the annual Haftarah, if you had to sum up all of Bilam and Balak, you could go to Micah 5, and you have a direct correspondence. But what the triennial has done is actually done a much more fine-tuned correspondence, and you see specific words that they're highlighting and specific images. And those are what has fascinated me, because it lines passages up. For instance, go to Micah 7:15. And you see, if you look in your triennial parasha, one has put Micah 7:15, paired it to Numbers 22, and the other has paired Micah 7:17 to Numbers 23. So they're slightly different. I think the second one is the match that fits linguistically best. But the first one is also cool. So,
but should we read those five verses, 15 and 20, just for the context?
Yes. So
Micah 7:15. I'll read it?
Yes.
Okay, Micah 7:15. As in the days when you departed from the land of Egypt, I will show you miraculous deeds. Nations will see this and be disappointed by all their strength. They will put their hands over their mouths and act as if they were deaf. They will lick the dust like a snake, like serpents crawling on the ground. They will come trembling from their strongholds to the Lord our God. They will be terrified of you. There is no other God like you. You forgive sin and pardon the rebellion of those who remain among your people. You do not remain angry forever, but delight in showing loyal love. You will once again have mercy on us. You will conquer our evil deeds. You will hurl our sins into the depths of the sea.
Where's Danny?
You will be loyal to Jacob and extend your loyal love to Abraham, which you promised on oath to our ancestors in ancient times.
Okay, so we got a lot of images here. So you have specifically in verse 18, carry our iniquity, and you pass over our crimes, our intentional sins. And then he's actually going to throw them. You're going to have mercy on us in verse 19. You're going to conquer our iniquities, and you're going to throw them into the depths of the sea. So it kind of fleshes out what that means. It's, you see that picture of someone taking over. Like, obviously, you sinned and you're helpless to save yourself. Someone comes in and conquers those sins, those iniquities, and throws them away from you, metaphorically, into the heart of the sea, into the deepest part where, you know, they're not going to come back. And nosei avon, to carry our iniquities. That's your image. Also, another important word in here is in verse 17, to lick the dust like a snake. I mean, obviously, the garden imagery of Genesis 3 comes jumping right back at you, because a snake would have to eat dust. That's part of the curse. But here, it's a symbol for what? Who is going to lick the dust?
The Gentiles.
All those nations.
Yeah.
When they see God and what God does with Israel, then they're going to lick the dust like a snake. They're so trembling and afraid. Basically, they're falling face on the ground and they're getting dust in their mouth. But the word yelahachu, to lick, slurp up the dust, it's actually a pretty rare word in the Bible. It's only five times. So the amazing thing is, guess where those five times are?
Numbers
22:4. So here you see Numbers 22:4. That's part of this, the triennial parasha, number 117. And there it's describing the fear of Moab of Israel, because they're so numerous, they say they're going to lick up all the grass just like a cow licks up all the grass of the fields. So there's not a snake, it's a cow. But it's parallel to fear. They're fearing this nation. And then it's the next time, or not the next time, it's also in Micah 7:17, we just read. And then it is in Isaiah 49:23. And so if you look at your Haftarot, you find Isaiah 49:23 and Micah 7:17 and Numbers 22:2. So three places in the whole Bible where this verb is described are pointed out for you, and in this triennial Haftarah. So you can definitely see that there's been a link based on this word and the concept behind it. To lick the dust. Wait, there's also Isaiah 51:3. I didn't look at that one. But another thing that pops out. First of all, I was reading this morning, thinking about Bilam. And in his original story, you have a little story before you get his actual oracles about the people. And you remember in chapter 22, you know, he sees God, he hears from God. And then he's on the road on his donkey, remember? And he's beating the donkey, and then the donkey finally speaks to him. And have you ever noticed what Bilam says his sin is there?
What is it?
Numbers 22. Let me find. Bilam. Balaam.
Balaam.
What he says his sin is. Go down. Because it's always strange, right? He refuses these people several times and finally he goes with them.
I did not realize you were standing in the road to oppose me.
Yeah. Lo yadati. I didn't know that you were standing there. And it just struck me that was his sin. Because he hears from God, he sees God's visions. He should have known. If an angel was there, he should have seen it. And he didn't. So something was blocking him. And traditionally, the interpretation is that his love of money or financial gain was what led him to, in the end, follow them. And at that point, he says, okay, I'll go home if this
isn't
for me. Well,
you know what's interesting is, I think it's Deuteronomy, it says, a bribe blinds the eyes.
Exactly. A bribe blinds the eyes of the straight people.
Yeah.
So that was just an interesting little thing for me. But in the end, then God says, no, go ahead and go. So even though, like, on the one hand, he's saying, I didn't really want you to do this. On the other hand, he's going to use his sin, so to speak, for his glory. And he's going to produce some of the most messianic, powerful blessings that we have. And so that's kind of a nice picture, too. But if you look at those, there's another thing that stands out that I think connects us. Numbers 23:9. Okay, so this is Bilam talking. From the top of the rocks I see them, from the hills I watch them. Indeed, a nation that lives alone. Am levadad yishkon. Uvagoyim lo yithashav. Among the nations, nobody thinks about them. And so, just like the Messiah is this contempt, or people despise them and don't consider them, the same way Israel, in a sense, is in isolation and not considered by anybody. And then immediately, mi mana afar Yaakov, who has counted the dust of Jacob? So you again have that dust imagery there.
It's interesting, right? Israel has never amounted to much in this world. If you want to talk about world history, you talk about you know, the Babylonians, the Assyrians, the Greeks, the Romans, the British Empire, the Americans, whatever, however you want to interpret history, you have these certain nations in your mind that this is what the world remembers. And then you have Israel, which obviously has had a huge impact, but not in that way. Its impact has been through the Word of God and what's come out of it and how it's played out in world history under the surface. And you can even talk about human rights and the value of people being made in God's image. There's all these things that have come out in this, the way we see things. And going back to Numbers 22, I'm kind of taking this on a rabbit trail here, why is Balaam coming to Balak, this king? What does Balak want him to do? He wants them to curse Israel because
they're too big. They're too great in number.
Well, and he's thinking like all of these world empires. You go to war and you get a great name by defeating your enemies. And, you know, I want to conquer my enemies is what he says back in the verses. And going to Micah 7, what is Micah saying God's going to conquer for Israel? Their enemies? I mean, it does say they're going to come and lick their feet and all this, but he says, I'm going to conquer your sins. And you, was it 7, 18? Wait. Sorry. Let me just get it here. 19. Okay. Yeah. I'm going to conquer your sins. And it reminds me going back to Jesus in Luke, and it talks about his birth. It says he will save his people from, and the line should be his enemies, from their enemies, because that's kind of your classic, your line, but it says he will save his people from their sins. And so that would be my argument for what you just brought up about Israel. Is it's alone, it's isolated, it's not a world player, and when people think of empires and power, but the focus is God's not about building empires, right? He's about forgiving people of their sins, changing their hearts.
And tying it into the messianic picture, you have the two Messiah figures, one Ben David, who's this ruler, and one Ben Yosef, who is a suffering servant. And it's interesting because in Leviticus 13:46, it talks about the person who has this nega, the disease. He's going to be unclean, and he's going to have to sit badad, sit in isolation outside of the camp. And so it's interesting how this concept of being in isolation and how God has singled out the people of Israel also kind of, it can be positive and negative in the sense of having to be in isolation, carrying something. Well, in the case of the Messiah, he's carrying the plagues and the nastiness that's a symbol of sin outside of the camp for this people who are also set aside to be God's special inheritance, God's special people. Hold on. That's it?
Last one.
Well, we didn't get back to the Micah 17, did we?
Okay, so end with that.
Yes. So go back to Micah
7.
Verse 7.
Verse 17.
17. And actually, if you go up a few verses before, verse 14, shepherd your people with your shepherd's rod, the flock that belongs to you, the one that lives alone in a thicket. So there you have the badad. Shochni levadad, which is the two words we've seen in Numbers 22. In the midst of the pasture land. And then allow them to graze in Bashan and Gilad as they did in days of old. What?
Okay. So.
So, okay.
So
we're done.
Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom, I think.
Yeah.